Okay, as you can see from the screen, this will be now our 36th class. We covered in the reading pages 486 through 503, which are really very straightforward, the book of Ecclesiastes and the Song of Solomon. That is, however, a little bit longer reading than most. It was 18 pages this week. I have tried to, as often as I can, you know, hold it down about 15 or 16, but I wanted to complete both books here, so I know it was a little taller order on the reading here this week, and a fair amount of the commentary, the uninspired commentary on those pages as well. So, we'll be going through a lot of material here this evening, but actually it's one of those nights that in a way maybe gives us a little extra time and kind of slow down too, because it's been very recently that I've taught the book of Ecclesiastes and the Song of Solomon. Most of you are very, very familiar with these books already anyway. And so we're just looking to do an overview as before. I've got only one thing really with Ecclesiastes that I'd like to focus on for this evening, but feel free to interrupt me if you have questions or particular verses that you struggle with or wonder about, as we actually have, you know, sort of a lighter duty night, I'm hoping. As a matter of fact, I really am hoping that. I don't feel terrible, but once again this afternoon I started feeling bad again. And so not altogether up to snuff myself here, so who knows, maybe we can get out a few minutes early tonight. It'd be a good night for that. Did want to just remind everybody, I think that this statistic itself is just amazing, that 11% of the entire Bible, not just the Old Testament, as I've said every single time, but the New Testament too, out of all 66 books, 11% of it is dedicated to David, and 5% to Solomon, 68 chapters that are devoted just to Solomon. And this because of a chart that I don't believe I've shown you before. You know, I just realized that I don't think I've gotten full screen with that. There, that'll help. Okay, here's an interesting approach to listing the Bible books. It's like the periodic table of the elements, isn't it? And so you've got the Old Testament on the left-hand side, including this stripe of 12, what we call the minor prophets right there, and the New Testament over here on the right. And as you can see, they're all grouped in lines to distinguish groups, as well as in colors, which you have a code for down here. So as you start in on your Old Testament, this is a very handy way to find your way around in the book and to remember the types of material that you find in the book. So I've put up a number of charts like this through the time that I've been with you, and this is just one I don't think I've shown yet. But the first five books there, in this sort of reddish color, are what we call the Pentateuch, which is the word that means five, or comes from five. But they typically refer to these as the Law of Moses, five books written by Moses. And you'll note that this color is history, and that includes all these Old Testament books, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, both Samuel, both Kings, both Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, and the one book of Acts. We have one historical book in the New Testament that will share that color. The books we're focusing on here tonight are these five, which typically are referred to as wisdom literature. They're not history, really. Though there's some history in some of them, and certainly in Ecclesiastes, we're going to be getting some history about Solomon and some of his thought processes. But these books are Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon, sometimes called Song of Songs. Those five books give us information that is particularly practical. And so it's not history, it's not doctrine, it's not law, though they have elements of those things in there. They're really there to help us to appreciate the physicality of the creation that God has given us and to give us wisdom and how to live on this material earth. And so Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon, these five books, three of them are written by Solomon. Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. Just to finish the chart, we have, of course, the major prophets, which are called that only because their books are larger, with the exception of Lamentations, which Jeremiah wrote. You have 12 minor prophets, and then, of course, Gospels, Acts, Paul's epistles, what we call general epistles, and finally the one book of what's usually referred to as prophecy in
the New Testament, they're giving it a separate color and calling it apocalyptic. But I would have just made it one of the prophets, I guess, maybe. Some people often do. But just to point out that the Bible is 66 books that covers all your bases. God has chosen to reveal himself to us in several different ways. History is the accurate recording of precisely what happened, both to individuals as well as to entire nations, and covering all of the world's history from its inception, its creation, in Genesis 1:1 and following. Some books are prophetic. They deal with revelations from God that have to do with physical events that are going to be fulfilled sometime in the future, often in the near future, often in the far distant future. We have books that are giving us, then, different approaches to the mind of God. When you come to the New Testament, you get to the Gospels, life of Christ, more history, Paul's epistles, which is all about how churches are to function here on this earth, solving various problems that were confronting those churches. A few of these letters, Timothy, Titus, Philemon, very, very personal. The others to the congregation at large. And then, of course, general epistles, which have to do with some very doctrinal Hebrews. Others, very practical, but not so focused in delivery, you know, to an individual congregation or to a certain person. And finally, the book of Revelation itself. Well, so far, we've looked at all these five books that Moses wrote. We've done a fair amount of the historical part. We've got quite a bit of that to go. We've done Psalms already and Job, but we've got, you know, these three books, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, that we're still working with. We've got a little over half of Proverbs, more to come. And then we've got all the prophets to go in all of the New Testament. In a year and a half, we're going to try to cover 66 books. And hopefully, after we've spent a near year and a half seeing all of this data and all of these different ways that God presents himself, you'll have, hopefully, you know, more of a kind of an overview like this chart's helping you with, or some of the others that I presented, just to be able to find your way around within the book itself. Oh, I guess I forgot to zoom in on that other one, but I'll let that go. There are legions, of course, of artists through the years that have been fascinated by the story of Solomon. So the last chart I've got for you today is actually just an artist's rendition of what Solomon's throne might have looked like. There are, as I say, many of these, but I like this one particularly, the way that it shows the lions. Remember, he had the lions that were ascending to his throne. This ostensibly is the approach of the Queen of Sheba. So you've got her retinue, and they're bringing in all the gifts and whatnot that we were told about. If you were to look very carefully here, you'll see these little arches are the bowed part with the strings in front that are invisible from that distance. But, you know, you have lyres there, so the professional musicians are there as a part of the court. And then you've got what would be maybe 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, 6 or 7 of his 1,000 wives. Would have been a really big throne. But as you saw in the reading this week, in one of those commentary boxes, and I was really glad that they put that forth, is to recognize that these wives most likely and primarily are covenantal agreements. They are alliances with neighboring kings, countries, and city-states. And so this was very common in the time. It is certainly being practiced by Solomon. We are told that that's what he is doing, as a matter of fact. And so he loved these foreign women. That is true. But you also have alliances that are taking place. The most prominent one is with Egypt, that he is marrying into the family so that now we are family. So if we're going to have a war, if we're going to have a trade disagreement, if we're going to have a problem, by the exchange of sons and daughters, and it was going both ways, so that we developed these relationships, it was a way to cement good, you know, feelings and behaviors
for the surrounding kings. Solomon didn't invent this idea. He's certainly not the first, not going to be the last. But he's also not the first or the last to get himself in a lot of trouble as a result. So there'll be more on that, you know, in the future. For now, I think I'll just go ahead and turn off the slideshow, TV here, and we'll just focus on the books themselves, which I forgot to bring in. Yeah, sorry about that. She had quite a long letter, and I got caught up in reading that thing and didn't get caught up in the class itself. So, let's everybody come on over then to 486, and we will take on the beginning here of the Song of Solomon. Okay, I thought what I'd do tonight first is say two things. Number one, I just love the book of Ecclesiastes. I hope you do too. But I sure met a lot of people who just hate it. I mean, hate it. Had a man tell me once that he didn't like to read it. He avoided it. He just thought it was, you know, such a downer. And consequently, I really hated this introductory transition that they've got to the book. And I thought maybe we'd just read through that and let me point out, and I think they really have far too dour a view of the book of Ecclesiastes. He says there on page 486, no book in the Bible is more surprising than this one. Well, already, I think I can find other surprising books, you know, so I'm not sure I'd go even quite that far. But he says, in a secular worldview, its purely philosophical approach to reality, and especially its thoroughgoing pessimism, it is unlike any other biblical text. To be sure, it concludes with an orthodox statement of faith, but this glimmer of faith follows chapter upon chapter of, what does he call it? Anguished doubt. I don't think it's that at all. And by the way, let me ask Jerry and Ted, too, if he's here. I'm hearing, you know, something in the mic, and I can't tell if it's because I'm touching something up here or if it's bumping up here, and I've noticed it the last several weeks I've been preaching, so if you guys could just kind of keep an eye on me and see if you hear some popping or something going on. I think it's my clothing or something, and then maybe I just need to place this differently, but you guys help me out with that. Okay, so in that first paragraph, brethren, that's just terrible, and I believe misses the whole point. Solomon is certainly not a man of anguished doubt, and the book is not a book of anguished doubt at all. So let me be talking about that a little more thoroughly, but let's read on what he's got to say. Perhaps equally surprising is the book's attribution to Solomon. Though Solomon's name is not mentioned, the author calls himself the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Because of this identification, and even more because of Solomon's traditional position as the master sage and model wise man, some scholars suggest that the preacher's words are indeed Solomon's. Well, yeah. I mean, who else? Because that designation isn't going to fit anybody else. And then it says, other scholars, however, note that except for the references to the preacher's wisdom and wealth, the book hardly fits the Bible's portrait of Solomon. Brother, I just have no idea what Bible translation he's reading, you know, but I've never found any kind of conflict or problem in that whatsoever. This fact, along with the late style and grammar used in the book, suggests to them that someone else wrote the book assuming the role of Solomon. Now, this has come up before. I want to make sure, you know, to point it out each time this comes up. I know I'm you know, running it into the ground, but you're all well aware. Those are, you know, the committee that put the book together's ideas. These ideas here, I think, are just absolutely ridiculous. They're certainly wrong. They're just incorrect. You know, and so periodically you're going to come up against these things. And let's all just be very mindful of the fact that that's certainly not Bible. And the things that these guys are suggesting right here, most of the time in these uninspired commentaries, they're very respectful to the Scriptures. So if there's anything surprising in that one, for me, it's not, you know, how you would look at the book of Solomon. It's that these men, who really most of the time seem to have quite a high regard for the Bible books, don't seem to have that regard here. But I did want to touch on something that, again, I've done briefly before, and I just want to emphasize that last sentence now in the first column. So the last sentence starts with, this fact, along with the late style and grammar used, suggests that someone else wrote the book assuming the role of Solomon. If you will go back and read the essays in the harmony that we're studying on Sunday mornings, you remember I pointed out that four of those essays deal with biblical criticism and the various arguments that have been put forth to suggest that certain Bible books, you know, ought not to be in the Bible at all. The authors of the Harmony, likewise, are defending the Scriptures and saying certainly they should be, but they delve into greater depth than we normally would, and more than I ever will, you know, on their argumentation. And the style and grammar are the two that you hear a lot about when you study textual criticism. So let me just touch on what that is. And again, what a very, very sandy foundation, you know, that would be to build upon. What happens is these men look at other books, like that Tale of Gilgamesh that you've also heard about in these uninspired boxes in the course of this week's reading, and they'll find these various similarities, and they study like crazy, you know, and then I think that they kind of lose their bearings a little bit, and they start putting things together with great confidence that don't seem to me to have a firm foundation whatsoever. Now, let me just point this out, for instance. I once was young. I still love Donna. But I don't write poetry like I used to. She still loves me. I hope to write more poetry before I die. But the letters that I wrote to her and the poetry that I composed for her all those very many years ago, 40 years ago, you might say, is a different thing than Larry writes today. So clearly, she was being courted by another man who took my name and passed himself off as me. And aren't I glad that she didn't marry him instead? How ridiculous is it to say that because I write this way now and I wrote that way in another publication, that in this case is separated by 40 years, and by the way, we're not sure, but the single book of Isaiah spans prophecies that are believed to be at least 40 years of prophecy and maybe 60. Okay? I like to think I'm a better writer today than I used to be and a poorer poet. Not as much practice. But to build a case that you're different people is ridiculous. Now think about the chart I showed you a few minutes ago. Is it not possible for a prophet to write history? Is it not possible for a historian to write poetry? Is it not possible for a poet to write law? And who wrote all the books? Is it not possible for God to have a range of style and presentation? Certainly. So you have this style and you have this grammar that these textual critics are applying all the time and making assumptions like, you know, well then, clearly this style is different than that and it varies in the course of the book, so it must be different authors. That is, brethren, just patently absurd and what men like the Harmony guys are warring against in those essays. Well, I can't remember the numbers, but it seems like it might be that I could pick up the book and tell you, though. Okay, so now these essays are 3 through 6. Source criticism, form criticism, redaction criticism, and criticism of the Gospel of John. So 3, 4, 5, and 6 in the harmony
which, by the way,
may not be developing the style or the grammar that these guys are referencing to the degree that they're trying to apply it here anyway when it comes to Gospels, but nonetheless, you know, you'll get some insight into that. So Brent, I just want us to, you know, recognize this, because you will surely have people who are going to doubt today various Bible books because they sat in some university course on the Bible. Courses which typically are designed to destroy all faith and confidence in the book. That's where you find your source criticism, your form criticism, this kind of stuff being taught in these universities of great and high learning. And then they build cases, and as we've already seen in the book of Proverbs, see if you can finish the proverb, the first to plead his case seems right until what? Until another comes and examines him. So the kids sit there, you know, and they listen to these scholarly men, and they just accept it, and they don't quite know how to even, you know, test it, and so they just take it for gospel, you know, established fact. It's the farthest thing from it. It's just not the case. Let's continue with these next two paragraphs. Whether Solomon or another writer, the author appears in the pages of the book itself as, above all, a teacher. Well, it's Solomon. And the Hebrew word for preacher, Koheleth, means one who leads an assembly. The book of Ecclesiastes consists of the words of this preacher. He diligently produced many proverbs and other words of truth so that the people might be admonished. He was a wise man, a teacher, a skilled writer, a seeker of truth, and an exhorter of his flock. Indeed, he was all these things, and not a liar, passing himself off as somebody else. Regardless of whether Solomon wrote the original, brethren, Solomon wrote the original. The book can be read in light of Solomon's greatness. Well, good for you to allow so much. Read in this way, Ecclesiastes offers a striking contrast between Solomon at the peak of his power and worldly success and this bleak and weary book. Brethren, I convince you of anything tonight. This book is not bleak, it is not weary, and it is not pessimistic, and it is not, you know, having anything more than a glimmer of faith in it. And it is, what was the other one? I think there was one other there. And I don't spy it right now. Okay, there's none of these things. And so then, he says, bleak and weary book, the writer's thesis is, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. There are inexplicable mysteries about life which defy easy solutions. Well, duh. Human wisdom is only partial. Tell me something I don't know. It cannot fathom the mysteries of God's creation. Well, amen to that. Only at the end, almost as an afterthought, does the preacher appear to make his peace with his world and his God. Well, that's, you know, that's just a terrible thing to say. So, let me give you an illustration, and then I'm going to read just one thread throughout the book of Ecclesiastes tonight. See if we can't, you know, contrast what these guys came away with and what Solomon was actually trying to teach, because they're, you know, just poles apart. My mom is a swim instructor. She taught me to swim when I was 5. At the age of 5, I figured out that water is wet. Have you noticed that? Have you noticed that water is always wet? The ice cubes are still wet. Okay. Have you also noticed that if you go down underneath that stuff for very long without any aid, scuba gear, snorkel, that you will die? Have you all noticed that? Okay. Well, let me tell you that this is just my bleak and pessimistic understanding of water. You know, I just, vanity of vanities, water is vanity. I tried as hard as I could to make it dry, but I couldn't do it. I'm not ready to move my baby dog. No. What I taught my children is the same thing my mom taught me. Don't be stupid when it comes to water. It flows downhill and not up. It is heavy. And when it's moving downstream, you can get killed about 19 different ways. So let me teach you how to swim in water.
which you won't be able to sing in very long because of hypothermia, which you can't go very deep and come back quickly again because of all the problems you have with oxygen in your blood. You'll get the bend. You know, and I set out to teach my kids about water. But in the end, all is vanity because I couldn't change water. What does Solomon do in the book of Ecclesiastes? He says to you, life under the sun is like this, and you can't do anything about it. It's vanity. It's futile. And there will be terrible things that are going to happen. You will have sin. You will have just, you know, crooked politicians. You will have, you know, stupid children who will inherit everything and then waste it all. Who knows? You'll just be a fool. Okay? The brethren, this is not bleak.
That was what I was looking for.
You know, and pessimistic. This is saying, wake up, people. Here's how it works. This is a book that is in a group that's entitled what? Wisdom Literature. It is teaching you how to swim in the world and how not to fight what is impossible to win. It is teaching you. Is it jujitsu that is... Where are the experts here? There. Is it jujitsu that's the one that uses your own momentum against you? This, I think jujitsu is the martial art where instead of learning how to, you know, apply force to destroy your opponent, it's all about simply stepping and moving so that whatever they're throwing at you, you are utilizing and parrying and using against them. Only the jujitsu is that particular form of martial arts. That's what this is. This is the material world's jujitsu. And if you're really wise, then you won't go home and just try to smother yourself with a pillow. He's not suicidal here. He's stating facts so that if you accept them, you can become one of the best swimmers the world ever saw in this sea of life under the sun. That is what the book is all about. So I truly, brethren, I just pity the people that avoid this book, that are depressed by this book, who see what he says, don't fight, you know, what is overpoweringly greater than you are, learn how to work with it, you know, as being a depressing kind of a thing. It's not that at all. So, when we went to the book of Ecclesiastes, of course, I was going in verse by verse, and we took a whole long time to do it. Tonight, I just want to skim through the book. You follow with me. And what I did is I just took my green felt tip pen, and I circled the verse number of every positive statement in this pessimistic, bleak, and depressing book. Okay? So tonight, let's just see what these guys totally missed. They're just blind to what Solomon was actually trying to do. Now, I don't deny for a moment, brethren, that the book begins by identifying the preacher, words of the preacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. That has got to be Solomon. And if not, then the book has no place in Scripture. Whoever wrote it is a liar. That makes him uninspired and foolish. Not a guy, I want to read it all. There's no wisdom in it at all if that's not what that means when he says that. So also do not want to deny, verse 2, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Now, true enough, God really doesn't appear in the book till the very end. But that's the point of his book. Let's for a minute lay God aside and just look at the world itself, the way the vast majority of people live their lives. And if you live your life in the absence of God, it is futile. Resistance is futile. The Borg are taking over, brethren. You are doomed. Because you can't win if all your hopes and dreams and activities, you know, are vested in this material world. You will reap corruption, Galatians will tell us. That's all you can reap. So David wants to approach this life that way, get to fix on how it works, and then teach us how to work with it. So is it not true
What profit, verse 3, has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away, another generation comes, the earth abides forever. You're pretty temporary. Sun rises, sun goes down, hastens to the place where it arose, and that just makes me want to kill myself. Well, no, I understand. This is how the planets work. In verse 6, the wind goes toward the south, turns around toward the north. The wind whirls about continually, comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with hearing, nor the ear, nor the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be. That which is done is what will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. Amen. Statements of fact ought not to be depressing. The Ducks are not as good a football team as they once were a year ago. Okay? So sue me. But Mariota's gone, isn't he? Things changed, didn't they? Only the fool will not recognize a reality. So yeah, there are cyclical things in life, and you better get used to it. You better figure out how the water works so you don't build your house in a riverbed. You better figure out how rain works and how the seasons work so you know when to plant and when not. You'd be smart even to figure out where to put your house based on how the winds blow. Or are you going to be more miserable in the winter than you really need to be? They're just statements of fact. But the fact is, you cannot change them. Don't be depressed about it. Accept it. Now then, with this basis, and he goes now into all of his experience, all of his wisdom, kept his wits about him, he's studying everything. You know, he's figured it all out like nobody ever has. So we ought to pay attention. Let's do my string for you. Now, if you want to do like I did, get your pen or your pencil out. And then I'll give you the verse number, and all you have to do is just circle that verse number, put a square around it or a squiggly cloud or whatever you want to do. What I'm about to do, whatever symbol you choose, is always and only now we will be reading the positive statements in the book, the joyful stuff, the wisdom that tells you how to get through this swimming pool from one side to the other and enjoy every minute of it. Verse 10 in chapter 2. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my reward for all my labor. Last night, brethren, I ate Hershey's Kisses before I went to bed. Little chocolate things wrapped in tinfoil. I wasn't suffering. I was having a good time. I did not withhold my heart from that. It's a pleasure in life. Solomon's doing the same thing. But his whole point is, brethren, that he had pleasure in life. I did not withhold my heart from any what? There's pleasure in life. There's lots of pleasure in life if you don't wake up and know where to find it. Verse 13 in that chapter. I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. That's a very positive statement. And I would much rather walk in the daylight than in the night. I really would. Most of you know where Don and I live. Love our location. It's half a mile from here. I can walk here if I want to. It's not but 2 blocks to the Safeway store. So when I run out of Hershey Kisses, I can be there on foot in about 90 seconds. Okay? But you know what I found out? Is that that neighborhood I'm living in is very well established. And the trees have long ago uplifted the sidewalks. So the first couple of times I tried to walk over to that Safeway, it's only 2 blocks in the night, about got myself killed. And I'm not railing against trees. I'm not angry at the concrete. Concrete behaves like that. Trees behave like this. It's what makes the neighborhood beautiful. But I'd rather do a walk when. That's because wisdom is seeing what is going on in the world. Foolishness and ignorance is like darkness, where you're just staggering and stumbling around and you're in jeopardy all the time because you haven't figured out how to live your life. Chapter 2. verses 24, 5, and 6 are on the first column of page 488, last paragraph before chapter 3 is verse 24. Nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. For who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. But to the sinner, he gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give to him who is good before God. Labor's vain. You're going to have to work all your life. That's a fact. You said so in the first couple of chapters. But you know what? Labor's also really good. And God is here by the end of the second chapter, isn't he? And a distinction between a sinful individual and a righteous individual. And how good it is to eat and drink, have joy in your labor. It's from the hand of God. Nobody had more enjoyment than Solomon. God gave him wisdom and knowledge and joy because he was good in his sight. And we can have all of those things too. I walked over to the Safeway store today. You know why? Because I ran out of Mountain Dew. That's right. My chosen caffeine delivery vehicle. I should walk and call it. So I walked this time in the daylight. Why? So I like drinking that stuff. So why would you get me some? Because I'm going to enjoy life. And God wants me to enjoy life. So if I got a hankering for a cup full of Mountain Dew, then I'm going to go get me some. And I'm not depressed, pessimistic, bleak. I'm suicidal because of it. Brethren, enjoy life is what Solomon's trying to say. Now we come to chapter 3, verses 11, 12, and 13, right directly across the page, same page, 488, but in the right-hand column. Verse 11, he's made everything beautiful in its time. He's put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. Know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. Now, how bleak and pessimistic is that? The book is telling you reality of the physical world and how to deal with it over here so you'll be the farthest thing from discouraged and depressed. On page 489 in chapter 3 at verse 17, it's indented there up toward the top, I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there's a time for every purpose and for every work. Now, Bruce, I think that's a really positive idea. Remember what he said in this same chapter in verses 1 through 8? There's a time for everything. You know what I figured out here this last year? I figured out the time for building fences is in the summer. And trying to do that in the winter, that's not the time for it. There's a time for everything. So when he's talking about the seasons, he's talking about the seeds, and he's talking about the winds, and he's talking about the rivers in the first chapter, he's talking about the same thing that he's talking about in chapter 3. There's a time for everything. So if you're smart, what are you going to do? Do these things in that time, and those things in this time. Figure it out, is all he's trying to tell us. So now we come down to verse 22 in chapter 3, the last verse in chapter 3. I perceive that nothing is better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, that's his heritage, for who can bring him to see what will happen after him? I am really not worrying about what's going to happen to my fence about 45 years from now. Because unless I'm 109, that fence isn't going to mean a thing in the world to me after I've croaked. Okay, I've got that figured out. So when should I enjoy it? You know, I got to tell you, I really do. I love my fence. It's a great fence. Better than your fence. I know it is, because it's younger than your fence. And it's built the way I wanted it instead of the way you wanted it. So brethren, there's nothing better than that. You should rejoice in it. Now, truly, I envy
so many of you, but particularly Dean, and I guess I've told him this from time to time, but, for me, he has just like the perfect job. Because I love working, but I don't really ever have much time for it. I had to do the remodel, and that's it. I'm not going to do much of it. He gets to go in every day and make a living with that. Now, I can probably tell you he's tired of it. He hates it. Stress the family and all the rest. Go. Yeah, but see, that's life, isn't it? And he's learning how to swim in it. But his work at the end of the day, what's really great about his work is when he starts dusting himself off and saying, the bell went off, it's time to go home, he can look right there and see what he did. And you know what happens to me when I leave here on Sunday night? I don't have a clue that you were even awake. I don't know if you have to spend a minute thinking about anything I said. I put hours into those presentations. I don't even know if you understood what I was saying. Let alone make a change in your life. Okay? Now, do I get plenty of feedback to make my life worth living? Sure. And I wouldn't trade my job for Dean's in a minute. But they are different, aren't they? They're really different. So I learned how to rejoice in my work. Baptisms, full house on a Wednesday night. There's a lot of things that make my life worth living. But I envy Dean, where there it is right there. He can remember every hour. He can see the beauty of it and the gracefulness of it. He can think back on the choices that he made and how well he's constructed that. He knows that thing inside out. Me, all I got's you. Vanity of vanity. All is vanity. Who knows whether all my work will be left to what? Solomon called a fool. I'm not complaining. What am I learning about what Solomon said? Oh, my works are different. My feedback is different. What am I supposed to do with it? Love it. Rejoice in it. Look, I don't have sleepless nights, brethren. I really don't. And nobody else should either. Chapter 4, verse 6, right at the bottom of the first column. Better a handful with quietness than both hands full with toil and grasping after wind. Well, amen! Now, I don't care. It doesn't matter how you feel about Jeb Bush. But that boy spent a ton of money. And they used to play the game. They said, he spent $10 million over here, so let's see, that's about $40,000 a vote. Okay. And now what's he got? For a while, he was running around and giving speeches and busier than he ever been in his whole life. I'm sure I can't imagine that kind of activity. And then what did it all come to? It all came to nothing. So how many of you were happier during his entire campaign while he was spending tens of millions of other people's dollars? Well, better a handful of quietness than both hands full with toil. He was certainly toiling. And grasping for the wind. It all came to naught. We're in chapter 4, verses 9 through 13. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. If they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who's alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Think of this Nioka tonight. And again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him. And threefold cord is not quickly broken. Better a poor and a wise youth, this one's totally separate from that previous, but 13. Better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. So, when you're envying the kings, you may be better off, than they are. You might have some one person that you can trust. And when you become king, often as not, kings would go mad like Herod the Great, thinking what? All day long. About palace intrigue and how many people wanted him dead and how was he going to survive the night, and maintain his throne and his crown. So you learn things in this book about who you really ought to respect and who you ought to envy, which is you and not somebody else. Turn the page to 490.
And we're now in chapter 5 at verse 9. The profit of the land is for all. Even the king is served from the field. And brethren, what land are we living in out of all the, what is it, 175 nations on earth? Which one have we got? The most productive, beautiful, you know, mineral and other products, you know, commodities, rich land that there's just ever been. And that's for us. This land is your land. This land is my land. Love it. Skip to 12. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much. But the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. I happened to be watching Donald Trump here the other day. And somebody asked him, I think he said, he only sleeps 3 to 4 hours a night. Now, if God has blessed him with some kind of, you know, personal fortitude so that he can be more productive in a day than the rest of us, he really doesn't need any more than that, you know, more power to him. But by the time you get done with the book of Ecclesiastes, what will you learn riches does to your sleep? It makes you miserable and hard to do it. Because the more you're trying to manage, the more you have to spend time worrying and thinking about it. And the less you have, the more free your mind is and the better your sleep is. On the top of the column, on the right-hand side of 490, are verses 18, 19, and 20 as you close out chapter 5. Here's what I've seen. It's good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him. For it's his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. The book, you know, is very careful to point out not a thing in the world wrong with being rich. Immoral people can be rich and their immorality would be a bad thing. But is it bad in and of itself to be rich? No. Go get all you can, you know, be righteous. Now we come to chapter 7, verses 1 and 2 on page 491. A good name is better than precious ointment in the day of death than the day of one's birth. Better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. Vanity of vanities, I'm going to die. One of my all-time favorite movies, What About Bob? Our little bedroom thing. We're going to die. We're all going to die. I laughed so hard. Couldn't sleep that night. But it's because of joy, brethren. It's because we're enjoying these things. Can I change the fact I'm going to die? No. So how much time am I going to spend worrying about that? Well, none. How much time am I going to spend preparing for it? I'm going to spend a lifetime. So I can be ready. In chapter 7 and verse 5, it's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. Verse 8, the end of a thing is better than its beginning. The patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. 11 and 12, wisdom is good with an inheritance and profitable to those who see the sun. For wisdom is a defense as money is a defense. But the excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it. Verse 19, chapter 7 still, right-hand column. Wisdom strengthens the wise more than 10 rulers of the city. And the first verse in chapter 8, who's like a wise man and who knows the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the sternness of his face is changed. Brethren, all those mopey, sulking, whiny, grousing people you meet, are they wise? Better put on a happy face, because the righteous and the wise, the Christians that read verses like this, they see that unhappy face and they know right now what Solomon is saying about you. What's he saying? That's foolish. That's ignorant. You need to get back up out of that. You need to figure that out. You need to do something different here. Necessary. Wisdom makes his face shine. Sternness of his face is changed. Chapter 8, verse 5. He who keeps his command, God's, will experience nothing harmful. and a wise man's heart discerns both time and judgment. 8, verse 12, next column. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and his days are prolonged, yet I surely know it will be well with those who fear God, who fear before Him. So don't envy those guys. God's on your side. Verse 15 in that same column. So I commended enjoyment, because a man has nothing better under the sun than to eat, drink, and be merry. This will remain with him in his labor all the days of his life, which God gives him under the sun. Some of my fondest memories are a trampoline on the 4th of July that my wife would be invited over to a member of the church, a good woman and husband, you know, who every 4th of July had the church over, you know, for 4th of July, and they had a trampoline. Oh, how we had fun. Okay? And it doesn't go away, nor should it. It remains with you, that enjoyment. Chapter 9, right-hand column of page 493, verses 7, 8, 9, and 10 in chapter 9. Go, eat your bread with joy, and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God's already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white. Let your head lack no oil. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he's given you under the sun, all your days of vanity. For that's your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. There is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you're going. Brethren, if you're not enjoying your family life, you're going to the grave anyway. You might as well enjoy the journey before you get there. Turn the page, and we've got only one in chapter 10. It's verse 19. A feast is made for laughter, and wine makes merry, but money answers everything. Money provides the feast and the wine now, doesn't it? Okay. I'm not going to get into all the theology about drinking wine and all of that. You know, we'll save that for another time. Now, though, in chapter 11, verses 7 through 10, we'll close out that chapter. Truly, the light is sweet. It's pleasant for the eyes to behold the sun. But if a man lives many years and rejoices in them all, yet let him remember the days of darkness, for they will be many. All that is coming is vanity. So it's a positive, brethren. Light is sweet, pleasant to the eyes. We'll find out later, or in more detail later, why it is you want to remember those dark days too, though. Now 9 and 10. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth. Let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these, God will bring you into judgment. Therefore, remove sorrow from your heart and put away evil from your flesh. For childhood and youth are what? They're vanity! That's the fact of the matter. So grab some, you know, all that gusto. Well, you can. Brother, did you know the number two killer of teenagers in our country is suicide? You know what number one is? Car accidents. Number two is suicide. Alcohol gets involved in the car accidents, and to a great extent in the suicides as well. What a tragedy that so many teens can't find joy in their lives. Probably never read the book of Ecclesiastes. Maybe, whatever the reason, you know, they just haven't figured out. These are the best years of your lives. Parents, you should be helping them with that. These aren't supposed to be the heavy years of burden where I can't wait to get away from my parents. It's not supposed to be that way. It's supposed to be pure joy. Which brings us to the end of the matter in chapter 12. Let's hear the conclusion of the whole matter, verse 13. Bottom of the right-hand column. Fear God. Keep His commandments. For this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. Is that a happy passage and a good passage or a bad one? But if you spent your life preparing for that judgment, then what? Then never be a better day in your life. Let me take 60 seconds and say for those that listen online, the Song of Solomon, I passed out a sheet tonight where I give an outline of the book, and then, in what's kind of confusing because there's two blocks and each has four columns, I've outlined for you the verses where each
of the three speakers slash singers can be found. There's a bride, there's a chorus, and there's Solomon, who is the groom.
So if you want to shoot me an email at larry@truthondisc.com, I'll send that to you. I had no intention of teaching the book again tonight, save to say only this.
I believe the Book of Solomon is a song about carnal, erotic, sexual love. It's about marriage, is what it's about. I do not believe it's an allegory of Christ in the church. That's not its purpose at all.
Furthermore, and this is sort of a pet peeve, there has been, you know, among churches of Christ, a very popular view of the Song of Solomon that has been, you know, embraced among us, that I think is certainly and absolutely incorrect. So I always try, you know, to pound on this just a little bit. If you have viewed the Song of Solomon as a song about the shepherd boy's love for the Shunammite or Shulamite girl, and how Solomon was a lecherous old man who was trying to subvert that love and steal her away to his harem because he's a sex addict. That is a very popular view among churches of Christ today. That is wholly and entirely incorrect. You don't have a book that Solomon writes in which he makes himself the what? The bad guy. Brethren, you don't even have a book written by a liar claiming to be Solomon, who claims for himself that he's the bad guy. Okay? So that view, popular as it's been among us, is utterly incorrect. Solomon is the shepherd. He truly loves her, and that's what this book is about.